This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, June 17th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. During Attorney General Merrick Garland's confirmation hearings earlier this year, he spoke passionately about his commitment to keeping the Justice Department nonpartisan.
I do not regard myself as anything other than the lawyer for the people of the United States. And I am not the president's lawyer. I am the United States lawyer. And I will do everything in my power, which I believe is considerable, to fend off any effort by anyone to make prosecutions or investigations partisan or political in any way. My job is to protect the Department of Justice and its employees in going about their job and doing the right thing according to the facts and the law.
Garland is a centrist. He believes in pursuing justice without becoming entangled in politics. Yet in the past few years, he's found himself in the center of two of the most fiercely partisan episodes in recent history. First, his nomination to the Supreme Court was blocked by obstructionist Republicans. And now, as Attorney General, he has to craft a legal response to the excesses of the Trump administration. He has already become a target for conservatives, who are portraying him as Joe Biden's lackey, and progressives who view him as insufficiently tough on the former president. David Rode, an executive editor of NewYorker.com, joins me to discuss the minefield that Garland is navigating and how his decisions will affect the country in the coming months and years. Hi, David. Welcome back. It's been too long.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Let's start by establishing what Garland is dealing with as Attorney General. Maybe you could give us just a few examples of decisions he's made in recent weeks that were not terribly easy.
Sure. And it is, yes, a minefield. One of the initial ones was sort of the E. Jean Carroll lawsuit. This was a defamation lawsuit that she filed against President Trump after he dismissed her rape claim by saying, you know, she's not my type. To the surprise of many Democrats, and even I think to the surprise of President Biden, Garland stood by institution. In the past, the government has defended public officials when they are sued for defamation. So he is continuing, Garland, to have the Justice Department defend Trump in that case. But that caused the Biden White House to sort of instantly distance themselves from that decision. They issued a statement that they didn't have any warning that Garland was going to do this. And Biden, sort of his spokesperson, condemned Trump in the way he reacted to this. So this is the central issue for Garland. He's following legal principle. He's this incredibly fair and, I've been told, incredibly kind person. But is that what an attorney general should do? When should an attorney general be completely neutral? And when should he sort of pursue a policy agenda of the elected president the attorney general serves?
Yeah, and let's talk about maybe a couple of the other controversial decisions. He's opposed the full release of a classified department memo that William Barr had used to distort the findings of the Mueller investigation.
Yeah, and in this case of the Mueller investigation memo, again, the institutional prerogative is to keep those institutional inside memos secret. That helps the institution in the long term. But Democrats and the public, you could argue, should know what that memo says, that to what extent did Barr distort the truth and hide the truth of the Mueller investigation. And again, Garland has come down on being an institutionalist. And progressives say that's a mistake. When you focus on the institution, you're protecting and enabling Trump.
You wrote about all of this this week, and you interviewed Jack Goldsmith, who served in the DOJ during the George W. Bush administration. And he pointed out that Garland faces even more challenges than his predecessors did after Nixon resigned. What are the bigger challenges here?
So the country is much more deeply divided, is what Goldsmith said. And it's interesting. He's a conservative. As you said, he served in the Bush administration. He's a fan of Garland. Liberal and conservative kind of legal scholars like what Garland is doing. But it's a completely different political environment today than it was after Watergate. Anything Garland does is going to be criticized by half the country, no matter what. Either Republicans or Democrats are going to be angry at him. So it's much harder for him to get political cover for some of the difficult decisions he's going to have to make. And we can talk about this separately, because he's overseeing multiple criminal investigations of Trump and his associates. And he's also overseeing a criminal investigation of Hunter Biden, President Biden's son.
A total nightmare for someone who is known for his temperance, as you say, his moderation and his, you know, utter commitment to the sanctity of the law, all of which made him perfectly suited for the Supreme Court. Even many conservatives agreed that that would have been a good job for him. But as you're saying, it's so different being attorney general, and you can't extricate the politics from the law and that job.
It's a strange job, and I kind of have learned in writing about this that, so what's okay for the attorney general to do in terms of politics is that for a president to come into office and say, I have a mandate from the people, I campaigned on, you know, say I'm going to crack down on pharmaceutical companies. That's fine. And any attorney general, you know, should carry out the law enforcement priorities of an elected president. What's not acceptable is if the attorney general, you know, at the president's request, decides to go after certain pharmaceutical company CEOs because they didn't give, you know, that president large campaign donations. And so this modern attorney general approach that emerged sort of after Watergate was, when it comes to investigations and prosecutions, the attorney general should be completely independent of how those proceed. And there should be no pressure or influence in any way from the White House. But when it comes to broad policy approaches, one thing Garland is doing is he's using consent decrees with law enforcement agencies around the country to prevent police abuses. That's a priority that Joe Biden, you know, campaigned on, and he has a Democratic mandate to carry that out. So that's fine. But it's very confusing, I think, to the public. Like, is this an apolitical position or not?
Right. And Donald Trump, as we know, essentially chased his first attorney general, Jeff Sessions, out of office. And then he viewed his second attorney general, Bill Barr, less as the country's lawyer and more as his own attack dog. So he left the Justice Department in a total mess. One's heart does go out to Garland. And maybe just talk a little bit more about just what he has inherited.
It's a complete mess. It's these new revelations just in the last few days about the Justice Department, you know, saying they were pursuing a leak, but they seized the metadata, the phone metadata of at least two Democratic members of Congress. This is, as far as I can tell, unprecedented. It's outrageous. And then a few weeks ago, there was the revelations about reporters for the Washington Post, the New York Times, and CNN. Having their phone records, that would include Adam Entus, who's our colleague now at The New Yorker. He had his phone records seized by the Justice Department. Again, the legal pretense that the Trump administration used was they were trying to find out who had leaked classified information to journalists. But it's really about intimidation, and it echoes of the approaches of many authoritarians now today. And it's vexing because in the digital age, there are all these records now of everything people, where they're doing, you know, who they're emailing, who they're calling, and there's all this data that can be subpoenaed, and there aren't really clear rules of the road from Congress about how to handle this. So it's a nightmare for Garland, and I feel for that. But there's a broader debate too. You know, he should use his powers. Some Democrats are arguing. Again, the Democrats have won a mandate here; they won the presidency, and Trump abused the powers of the Justice Department by constantly pushing for political gain from everything his attorney generals did. And that was a real problem with Barr. So there's this concern that again, Garland might be too cautious. He shouldn't be a judge, act like a judge overseeing a trial, which he did, you know, successfully and very fairly for decades, that the attorney general's job is different.
Yeah, so Trump was trying to use the country's most powerful law enforcement agency and the tech sector's data collecting to smear people he considered his enemies, journalists, and as you say, two members of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell. And again, unprecedented. So this is one of the reasons Democrats are so anxious and angry about the direction Garland is heading.
They are, and they want to hold Trump accountable. And then, frankly, from a political perspective, they want to talk about these issues publicly. They want to expose the wrongdoings of Trump. There's a very, you know, the former president is very involved in politics, is widely expected to run again. So they want more of this to come out. They want to remind voters of these activities. And yet Garland is trying to, you know, restore a view of the Justice Department as neutral and apolitical. And there was a consensus after Watergate that Nixon was wrong and he had resigned in shame. That consensus doesn't exist. This is a deeply, deeply and, you know, almost evenly divided country.
Yeah, and that's the key difference here.
Yes, the political landscape is completely different. And then, again, you live in this digital age where there's all kinds of information you can obtain and subpoena from the government. And so it's a tremendous challenge for Merrick Garland.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
One of the most explosive issues he faces, and the country faces, is the January 6th insurrection by Trumpists. At the House hearing on the issue, a Republican representative, Paul Gosar of Arizona, complained, "The DOJ is harassing peaceful patriots across the country." Could you explain exactly what the department's role is in that investigation?
Sure. Again, it's massive. More than 400 people have been arrested for their role in the January 6th riot. This is believed to be one of the largest, if not the largest, criminal case ever investigated by the federal government. And again, the buck stops with Merrick Garland. The biggest question as that case is investigated is what role, if any, did Donald Trump or his allies, Roger Stone and Michael Flynn, are two focuses of suspicion, play in encouraging and even coordinating the assault on the Capitol. And because of Congress's inability to agree on a January 6th commission, again, this hot potato lands in Merrick Garland's hands. So that's, and then there's all kinds of individual people who went inside the Capitol and, you know, their defense attorneys are saying they didn't do anything violent inside the Capitol, and they're sort of being caught up in this whole thing. And there's an overzealous prosecution by the Justice Department. So it's an incredibly complex case. And Jack Goldsmith told me this, that Merrick Garland is going to have to make very hard decisions. Who do you prosecute on January 6th? You know, do you prosecute Donald Trump? And again, do you prosecute Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son?
Remind us on the Hunter Biden case, what's involved there.
Yes, there's an active investigation that's, you know, overseen by the federal prosecutors in Delaware in terms of Biden's. It's not clear, but Hunter Biden's sort of lobbying activities and whether he carried them out properly and disclosed everything he was doing. There's a similar investigation to Rudy Giuliani, his lobbying, both of them lobbying on behalf of foreign governments. Did they disclose and register all their activities as they were supposed to? So it's an enormous amount of work. You've got a million other issues, civil rights issues that Garland wants to prioritize, voting rights. He wants to defend voting rights, and he's under pressure to respond to Republican state legislatures, you know, restricting voting access in some states.
Most states.
Defending abortion rights across the country. So there's, and again, the policing issue I mentioned earlier. It's an incredibly, you know, busy and fraught to-do list for Merrick Garland.
And just getting back to January 6th for a second, what do we know about his broader domestic terrorism strategy?
Yes, and so this week, the day before President Biden met with President Putin, the White House unveiled a new strategy for countering domestic terrorism. That's fraught as well. I've talked to law enforcement officials, and the FBI in particular is very leery of a policy that some Democrats have pushed for, where you would designate certain organizations in the United States to be terrorist organizations. That happens with foreign groups, but American citizens and domestic organizations have more protections under the Constitution, where they can, say hateful things, but that's protected First Amendment rights. The problem is the hateful speech turns into violence, which is illegal. So how do you crack down on domestic extremism that can become violent without playing into the hands of sort of conspiracy theorists? You mentioned, Representative Gosar saying that, the DOJ was harassing, law-abiding citizens. So if there's too aggressive a crackdown on domestic terrorism or domestic extremism, you can see Trump and Republicans saying, we are the victims. An oppressive federal government is infringing on our abilities to say what we think and organize politically.
So Janet Reno served as Attorney General for all 8 years of Bill Clinton's presidency, the only Attorney General more than a century to stick with the job that long. Do you think Garland can somehow survive these unbelievable political storms?
I think Garland wants to survive these political storms. He's determined to serve, but you have progressives already calling for him to be, ousted. There was a piece that ran in the New Republic where the authors were calling for Garland to be removed. They said it wasn't intentional, but his, focus on fairness, his focus on defending the law and the institutional, rulings by the Justice Department is leading him to unwittingly protect Donald Trump. And therefore, according to these progressives, he shouldn't be the Attorney General. So we'll see. But it's amazing. And looking at all these issues, you realize how much of an impact the Justice Department has on so many issues. It's not just about law enforcement. It's about, voting, environmental protections, antitrust measures against big tech companies.
Immigration,
you name the issue, there's got to be decisions by the Justice Department and Merrick Garland.
Thanks so much, David.
Thanks, Dorothy.
David Rode, an executive editor of NewYorker.com, is the author of In Deep, the FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.